This is a podcast from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research institute that explores budget policies and issues affecting low and moderate income Americans. I'm Michelle Bazzi. Welcome to this policy briefing.
This morning we're releasing one of our most important health policy analyses of the year. The analysis is by Jim Horney, now the Director of Federal Fiscal Policy here at the Center, and Paul Vandewater, now a senior fellow here at the Center. Horney and Vandewater are widely regarded as two of Washington's most knowledgeable budget experts. Jim Horney was chief of the Budget Projections Unit at the Congressional Budget Office for a number of years, and Paul Vandewater was the assistant director of CBO for a number of years. Their work on this paper was sparked by a series of pronouncements over the past month on Sunday talk shows, cable, op-ed pages, and the like, that the CBO cost estimates showing that the House and Senate health bills are paid for and slightly reduce the deficit shouldn't be taken seriously for two reasons. First, that history shows that Medicare savings provisions enacted in the past don't stick, that they're not allowed to take effect. And second, that there's a gimmick in the bills because they don't include the cost of continuing to prevent the scheduled deep cuts in Medicare payment positions from taking effect. As experts in this area, Jim and Paul thought that these pronouncements were likely based on faulty assumptions, that not on detailed hard analysis. So they conducted an exhaustive analysis in which they looked at every significant Medicare savings provision enacted into law in the last 20 years. They also looked at the details of the history of the controversial Medicare physician fee payment provision since its enactment in 1997. If you read their report, you'll see, I think, that their findings are indisputable. Based on hard facts and budget numbers, rather than unchecked assumptions, they show that what has started to become the conventional wisdom, that Medicare savings provisions are not allowed to take effect, is flatly wrong. Their analysis considers another issue as well. How well do the House and Senate bills do in including measures to restrain health care costs and slow their growth? Is this a case where we know things that would work, but they're not in the bills? And here, in addition to Jim and Paul, we have with us on today's call one of the nation's leading experts on healthcare cost issues, renowned MIT economist and healthcare expert John Gruber, whose expertise includes not only his acclaimed research on these issues, but also his role since its inception on the board of the Massachusetts Connector, the principal state health insurance exchange in the United States, where he's been in the middle of designing and monitoring the nuts and bolts of the first healthcare reform system of this nature. We're going to hear now from Jim Horney, then Paul Vandewater, and then John Gruber. And once they're done, we'll go directly to your questions. First, Jim Horney.
Thank you, Bob. As Bob indicated, we undertook this in the spirit of, of late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who once famously said, "Everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts." It seemed to us that if we're going to have a debate on this issue, people should understand what the facts are and then form their opinions based on those facts. But we looked at the historical record, and what the historical record does is contradict the claim that Congress is generally unwilling to let promised Medicare cuts take effect. In discussing this, I'll talk about three things. First, the overall record of Medicare cuts in recent decades. Second, the particular reasons why Congress chose to ameliorate some of the Medicare cuts enacted in 1997. And finally, the facts about the so-called sustainable growth rate, or SGR, adjustments in physician reimbursement rates that were established in 1997 that have not been allowed to take full effect. So what does the record show? Significant Medicare cuts have been a major part of every substantial deficit reduction effort since 1981. In our analysis, we focused on the significant Medicare cuts enacted in the major deficit reduction legislation of the last two decades, that is 1990, 1993, 1997, and 2005. Our conclusion is that Congress has allowed the vast bulk of Medicare cuts enacted in those bills to take effect, and that special circumstances help explain the relatively limited instance when cuts were subsequently curtailed. What did we find in particular? First, Congress did not later undo any significant cuts that it enacted in 1990, 1993, or 2005. Second, while Congress did later ameliorate Medicare cuts that it included in the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, which was both the sustainable growth rate and other cuts, the great majority of the savings in the 1997 legislation were realized. Second, given the unique circumstances of that period, it's actually surprising that Congress did not undo more of the savings. Let me explain briefly how we did our analysis of what happened to the 1997 cuts and more about our findings. First of all, we took CBO's estimate of the savings from Medicare provisions in the 1997 law that were produced at the time the bill was enacted. Those totaled $382 billion over 10 years, excluding the estimated savings from the SGR, which we addressed separately and I will talk about in a moment. We focused on the non-SGR savings estimated for fiscal year 2007. That's the last fiscal year that was covered by the CBO cost estimate at the time the bill was enacted. Those savings totaled $56.7 billion in 2007. We then looked at every bill enacted over the next 10 years that had a significant effect on Medicare spending, and we calculated the total effect of all those bills on Medicare spending in 2007. We included all of the cost of those bills to Medicare other than the cost of the new Medicare prescription drug benefit that was enacted in 2003. What we found is that $45.4 billion, four-fifths of the $56.7 billion in promised savings under the 1997 law, were preserved. So even in the one instance where some cuts were undone, the great bulk of the cuts survived. In a nutshell, we found virtually 100% of the 1990 savings survived. Virtually 100% of the 1993 savings survived. Virtually 100% of the 2005 savings survived. And 80% of the 1997 savings survived. Furthermore, as for the cuts in 1997, keep in mind what was happening with Medicare spending and the budget in the years just after 1997. In the 10 years before 1997, Medicare spending had grown at an average rate of 10% a year. The Medicare provisions in the 1997 law were intended to help slow that growth, but the effects were expected to be relatively modest. In fact, in 1998, Medicare grew by only 1.5%. And in 1999, for the only time in the program's history, Medicare expenditures were actually less than they had been the year before. In that year, Medicare spending, 1999, Medicare spending was $24 billion, or 10% lower than CBO had projected after taking into account the savings from the 1997 legislation. Not surprisingly, many healthcare experts, as well as healthcare providers and lawmakers, thought that maybe the cuts in the bill had gone too far. At the same time, another surprising and dramatic development occurred. For the first time in 28 years, the budget was balanced in 1998. Now, CBO had projected that after the enactment of 1997 legislation, that the budget would reach balance, but not until 2002. Instead, we had balance in 1998. Furthermore, surpluses and projections of future surpluses grew over the next few years. Remember that in 2001, both CBO and OMB projected that without changes in then-current policies, surpluses would total $5.6 trillion over the next 10 years. And remember that then Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan warned that we were in danger of harming the economy by paying off all of the national debt. With all that in mind, it's not surprising that Congress decided to ameliorate some of the Medicare cuts that had been enacted in 1997. As I say, what's really surprising is that Congress still allowed the great bulk, again about four-fifths, of those cuts to go into effect. This hardly demonstrates a general unwillingness on the part of Congress to allow Medicare cuts go into effect. Now let me quickly address the issue of the SGR cuts. First, just a brief description of the SGR mechanism, which was enacted as part of the 1997 law. It is a formula for annually updating the basic rate that Medicare pays for physician services, a formula that's tied to targets for total Medicare physician-related spending that are determined by a sustainable growth rate. That sustainable growth rate takes into account inflation and some, but not all, of the other factors that drive Medicare spending. For several years after 1997, total spending was less than the target. As I said, Medicare spending declined dramatically after 97, and the physician reimbursement rate was actually increased by more than the increase in inflation. By 2002, however, total spending began to exceed the target, and the SGR called for a 4.8% cut in the physician reimbursement rate. That's a 7.2% cut after accounting for inflation. Congress allowed this cut to go into effect, but then balked at allowing similar or larger cuts that would have been required under the formula to fully take effect in future years. Because Congress has repeatedly taken action since 2002 to keep the full cuts under the SGR from taking effect, critics have made this issue the poster child in their argument that Congress tends to claim big savings from Medicare cuts, but then comes back later and undoes the cuts. Unfortunately, while everyone is aware that Congress has blocked the SGR cuts, almost no one really understands the SGR situation. Our analysis tries to remedy that by pointing out these facts. First, Congress did not claim big savings from the SGR. The total savings attributed to the SGR when it was enacted were $12 billion over 10 years. That's out of $394 billion in total Medicare savings in the 1997 legislation. That is, the SGR cuts accounted for only 3% of the total promised Medicare savings. Second, Congress did not simply repeal the SGR and let physician reimbursement rates grow willy-nilly, as critics would lead you to believe. In fact, though Congress has since 2002 prevented the full SGR cuts from going into effect, it has actually cut physician reimbursement rates substantially below what was needed simply to keep pace with inflation. Since the 4.8% reduction in the reimbursement rate in 2002, the rate has been increased at an average annual rate of about 1%, far less than the average 2.5% a year increase in the Medicare Economic Index, which measures inflation and the cost of providing health care, with an adjustment for increased productivity. Even if the Congress overrides the January 2010 scheduled 21.5% reduction in physician reimbursement rate that the formula calls for, which they almost certainly will do, and instead freezes the rate at today's level, the rate next year would be 17% below the rate in effect for 2001, adjusted for the MEI. Finally, the SGR is a badly designed mechanism that turned out to require cuts far in excess of what had been anticipated, and that could have severely affected the access of seniors to physician care. It represented an effort to control total physician-related Medicare spending by addressing only the rate at which physicians are reimbursed, while ignoring the other big factors that determine that spending, the volume and type of services provided. It was based on the assumption that the slowdown in the growth of the volume and intensity of health services system-wide, that's both publicly and privately funded, that was experienced in the mid-1990s, just before this bill was enacted, would continue. When that growth actually reverted to its higher long-term trend in the early part of this decade, the cuts required by the SGR became unexpectedly large, and it became clear that the SGR was a blunt tool that could not by itself accomplish the goal of controlling physician-related spending. Had Congress let the cuts go into effect, Medicare beneficiaries could have suffered real harm. Congress's nonpartisan expert Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, MedPAC, recently concluded that the SGR does not control volume growth, is inequitable to physicians who do not increase volume unnecessarily, and calls for large cuts in reimbursement rates that would, quote, threaten beneficiaries' access to physician services. So the real lesson from the SGR is not that the Congress is generally unwilling to let Medicare cuts take effect. It is instead that Congress is not so foolish as to let mistakes it makes in policy proposals produce unanticipated and harmful cuts, and that Congress should be careful in designing Medicare law and focus on changes that are well designed to accomplish reasonable goals, policies that are quite different from the SGR. As Paul Vandewater and John Gruber will discuss now, that is what Congress is doing in the health reform bill, with Medicare and other health system proposals that are well designed to achieve reasonable savings in Medicare and slow the long-term growth of health care costs. And now, Paul.
Thanks, Jim. I'm going to address two additional misconceptions about the health reform legislation. One relating to the sustainable growth rate formula, which Jim has just discussed, and then secondly, the greater misconceptions the health reform bills do little to slow the growth of health care costs. My first point is to emphasize that fixing the sustainable growth rate formula, and Jim clearly described why it needs to be changed and not allowed to continue in effect, that fixing the sustainable growth rate formula is not a cost of health reform. Critics contend that the cost of the permanent fix, which could run to the price of $200 billion or more over 10 years, should be counted as a part of health reform. And if that cost were included, those critics say, health reform would not be deficit neutral. But, and let me be very clear about this, fixing the sustainable growth rate formula has nothing to do with health reform. Indeed, Congress is unlikely to let the SGR cuts take place, and it is almost as unlikely to offset the cost of scrapping them. But that cost is neither part of nor in any way a result of health reform. The federal government will incur the cost of fixing the SGR regardless of health reform, not because of it. If health reform legislation were to die tomorrow, the full cost of fixing SGR would remain. Certainly, many of us would agree that it would be better if Congress would pay for the cost of canceling the SGR cuts, just as it would be best if Congress paid for extending the Bush tax cuts. But that issue is separate from the question of how health reform affects the deficit. Now, turning to another point, critics also complain that under the House and Senate bills, total health care expenditures in the U.S. will rise in the near term, not fall. Those critics point to an estimate by the chief actuary at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that under the House bill, which would extend coverage to two-thirds of the uninsured, national health expenditures would increase by 1.5% in 2015, the year in which the bill's coverage expansions would be fully phased in. But that increase is no surprise. In fact, it's one of the main objectives of health reform. We expect and we want people who gain insurance to use more health care. But that increase is also not the issue. The real issues are whether health reform includes provisions to cover the cost of expanding coverage so that deficits don't increase, and even more important, whether health reform includes steps that begin to slow the rate of growth of health costs so that health spending is lower in the long run. Fortunately, the two bills passed both tests with flying colors. It is particularly noteworthy that both the House and Senate bills would achieve significant coverage expansions without adding to the deficit. In fact, CBO says that both bills would reduce the deficit over the next decade and thereafter. In fact, the bills include a wide range of measures to control health care cost growth. The House bill goes further than the Senate in some aspects of cost control, particularly in achieving efficiencies in Medicare and in structuring the new health insurance exchange to promote effective competition. The Senate bill also goes further in some other respects, particularly in imposing an excise tax on high-cost insurance plans. As it crafts final legislation, Congress, we believe, should include those provisions from each bill that hold the greatest potential for cost control and, where possible, make those cost control measures even stronger. But in many respects, if not most respects, the House and Senate bills are comparable. In the near term, the bulk of the savings in the two bills stems from reductions in Medicare payments. On the one hand, reductions in payments to private Medicare Advantage plans, which are now overpaid by 14%, according to the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. And on the other hand, reductions in annual payment updates to hospitals and other health care providers in traditional Medicare. But equally or more important, the bills contain a long list of systemic reforms in health care payments and delivery. These changes will not have a big effect in the short run, but they hold considerable promise for slowing the rate of growth of health care costs in the long run. And I will now turn to John Gruber to discuss these systemic reforms.
Thank you, Paul. Before I do, I just want to emphasize, I had nothing to do with writing this report, but I really want to recommend it as just an excellent piece of scholarship on a very important issue. I think it really, I learned a lot from reading it, and I think it really is a wonderful example of bringing evidence to bear on what was otherwise a somewhat fuzzy topic. What I want to do is just spend a couple minutes talking about the cost control aspects of these bills and talk about why I think these bills, and in my view, particularly the Senate bill, move us forward on cost control in three critical ways. The first way is that these bills do everything that health economists advocate to control costs. It's sort of a no stone left unturned approach, I would call it, in the sense that we don't really know how best to control costs in the long run, but we know some things we should try, and those things are in these bills, particularly the Senate bill. And in particular, I focus on five aspects. The first is the introduction of insurance exchanges, which will increase competition in insurance markets and lower administrative costs for both individuals and small businesses. The second, and my personal favorite, is the high-cost insurance excise tax, which will end the uncapped tax subsidy we now have to very expensive insurance plans, leveling the playing field so that people choose their insurance plan not because of a tax break, but rather because of what's best for them. The third is research on comparative effectiveness. It's amazing that, one-sixth of our economy is devoted to a sector about which we have incredibly little knowledge on what works and what doesn't. And clearly, if we want to control costs in a sensible way, we need to start learning more about what works and what doesn't. The fourth is setting up the independent Medicare advisory panel, the IMAC, which will try to depoliticize rate decisions by subjecting them more to an up-and-down congressional vote, sort of a base-closing commission approach to Medicare rate setting. And then finally, there's a very large number, a really extraordinary large number of different pilots and experimenting with alternative delivery systems. Now, in this one, there's been a lot of criticism I've heard of, gee, pilots are meaningless, let's not do them, let's move forward with really doing reform. And here, let's move forward, take for example, accountable care organizations. Let's not pilot that, let's just do it. The problem I have with that is we're not actually, quite frankly, sure how they will work or whether they will work. There's a lot of unknown in cost control, and doing pilots right now is exactly the right thing to do. We need to try a number of different approaches, see what sticks, and then move forward on transforming our healthcare system towards what works. But the notion that we should move faster is really ill-informed because it's not considered how little we actually know about what's going to work and what's not, and that's what these pilots help us learn. So the first broad way that this will help us on cost control is through these various measures. But I think a second way that these bills help us with cost control that shouldn't be lost is that by moving to universal coverage, we make system-wide cost control more feasible. So if you think about all the kinds of cost controls we think about that might work, like accountable care organizations or changing reimbursement rates, those all work through insurance markets and through insurance design. It's hard to implement those if a large and continuously growing share of our population is not insured. How do you do cost control on how do you squeeze that pillow of cost when, in fact, when you squeeze it, a bunch of folks come out the other side and head to be uninsured? That doesn't really work. We need everyone under the umbrella to make reform work. And then finally, the third way these bills approach cost control, and the vaguest, but I think potentially the most important, is that by getting universal coverage off the table as a point of discussion, we could turn our focus increasingly to cost control. Right now, politicians and analysts and health policy experts are torn between the twin goals of universal coverage and cost control. We don't yet know how to control costs. We have a bunch of good ideas which are embedded in the Senate bill, but we don't really know for sure what's going to work. We do know how to get to universal coverage, and this bill gets us a lot of the way there. So we should do that first. And as we've seen in Massachusetts, when we do universal coverage first, that motivates cost control. In fact, in the wake of our universal coverage bill, we actually turned to the most significant cost control proposals we've seen in a couple of decades in our state that are now before the legislature. So I think this idea of what John Kingsdale, the connector, has called sequential health reform, doing coverage first and then using that as motivating, taking on the hard problem of cost control, I think is exactly the right way to proceed. So I think that's the third sort of political economy argument for why these bills really help us get to the long-run goal of cost control. And I'll stop there.
This concludes the presentation portion of the briefing from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. You can follow us on Twitter at Center on Budget, find us on Facebook, or create a My Center account at centeronbudget.org.